McDonald's workers go on strike, and politics follows. It's the Friday, May 24th edition of the Business News Hour. Thanks so much for clicking through. You know that Harriet Tubman $20 bill? Not so fast, says the White House. Today, it seems, is Huawei Day. We've got two stories on that. Time for a little history on black reparations. I think you're going to find this stunning. Those stories and more, along with our Friday adventure with Jeff Pitts from City View Magazine, and stuff to do in the metro this weekend into next week. But first, from Anna Maria Island on the Gulf Coast of Florida, it's the Business News Headlines.
Insight on Business, the News Hour, with Michael Libby, is made possible through the support of Arion, human resources, payroll, and call center help for businesses. AURION.com. AARP of Iowa. Real possibilities. AARP, Iowa. The Business News Hour, also presented by Tero International, your elite training team at TERO.com. The Business News is next.
Thank you, Hunter Pease, and welcome to the Friday edition of the Business News Hour, coming to you today again from the Island Coffee House, which is located on Anna Maria Island in the Gulf Coast of Florida. You want to reach out to us on Twitter, you can do that. We are at IOB_NewsHour. Me personally, yeah, you can find me there as well. I'm at Michael Libby. Libby is spelled L-I-B-B-I-E. Let's get into it, shall we? McDonald's workers went on strike in 13 cities, and three Democrats running for president marched with them in their effort to win over working class voters on the picket lines. Julian Castro, Washington Governor Jay Inslee, and New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio rallied with workers in three of the cities where McDonald's employees had organized a work stoppage to demand $15 an hour wage and the right to join a labor union. In recent months, fast food workers have seen their efforts to raise wages pay off. They've already pushed lawmakers in four states to adopt a $15 minimum wage so far this year, and they're building support in Congress for a similar hike at the federal level. Last month, the presidential frontrunners pledged their support for a $15 minimum federal wage. But despite their political successes so far, McDonald's workers are frustrated that the company has done little to address their concerns. Workers also say they need a labor union to force McDonald's to take action. But the company, based in Chicago, wants to avoid all of that at all costs. It won't recognize McDonald's workers as its own employees, because most of them work at independently owned franchises. The company is locked in a labor dispute over whether the fast food chain is considered a joint employer and is therefore partially liable for labor violations committed by individual franchisees. McDonald's argues it is not a joint employer, so it cannot be held legally accountable for sexual harassment and other illegal workplace behavior at any of its independently owned restaurants. However, workers disagree. They say the company has too much control over franchisee restaurants and workers to make that claim. Julian Castro was at a McDonald's in Durham, North Carolina. Governor Jay Inslee was in Chicago. And Mayor Bill de Blasio was rallying with workers in Des Moines, Iowa. McDonald's Corporation, by the way, had a net income of $5.9 billion last year on revenue of over $21 billion. Recently, the stock has been climbing on expectations the stock price could go from $198 a share to $215 yet this year. Don't plan on seeing a Harriet Tubman $20 bill anytime soon. The redesigned bill bearing Tubman's face, which was supposed to debut next year, will not be coming out for nearly a decade. All of that according to Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin. Planning started years ago to have a Tubman replace former President Andrew Jackson on the $20 bill. Tubman, who was born into slavery and became a noted abolitionist and political activist, would be the first black woman to have her face on U.S. currency. The new bill was scheduled to be released in 2020 to coincide with the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment, which gave women the right to vote. Mnuchin said a redesign of the bill's security features will still come out in 2020, but that the issue of changing how the bill looks most likely won't come up again until 2026, and the new $20 bill won't be printed until 2028. Mnuchin did not explain why the Tubman bill won't be produced on his watch. He also did not state whether he personally supports seeing Tubman on the money. He said, quote, "I've made no decision as it relates to that," end quote. President Trump said during the 2016 campaign that he did not support putting Tubman on the $20 bill, calling the plan pure political correctness. He suggested instead having Tubman on the $2 bill or another bill. Mr. Trump has expressed admiration for President Andrew Jackson, who was a slave owner and had a portrait of him put in the Oval Office. U.S. President Trump has raised the possibility of easing restrictions on Huawei as part of a broader trade deal with Beijing, despite labeling the Chinese telecommunications giant as being very dangerous. The comments, which appear to run counter to Washington's hardline policy on Huawei, come just a week after the U.S. Department of Commerce placed the company on a trade blacklist, effectively barring it from conducting business with U.S. companies. Yesterday, however, Trump said that Huawei is something that's very dangerous from a security standpoint, but then he floated the idea of using the Chinese tech firm as leverage in the ongoing trade negotiations with China. Meanwhile, according to at least one analyst, China technology giant Huawei has enough inventory to sustain its smartphone and 5G networking equipment business for most of the rest of the year. That would mean the company could wait out a U.S. blacklist. According to Sebastian Hua, an investment analyst at CLSA, Huawei's smartphone business has 5 to 6 months' worth of inventory, and its 5G networking equipment business has 9 to 12 months' worth of supplies. He went on to say that Huawei's subsidiary, HiSilicon, which designs chips for Huawei equipment, has been increasing its capabilities and capacity in the past few years and is able to supply 80% to 90% of Huawei's needs. In a bid to reduce its reliance on U.S. suppliers, Huawei has invested in its own chip technology, especially for smartphone processors and 5G chips. So once again, stay tuned. Well, it's Friday, and the day before a long weekend. So how about a bit of a history lesson on black reparations? I know this is a topic that has been bubbling up for several years, and as the 2020 campaign heats up, it's getting more attention. Well, here we go. Let's go back a ways. As the Civil War wound down in 1865, General William T. Sherman made the promise that would come to be known as the 40 Acres and a Mule Promise. What that meant is he wanted to redistribute a huge tract of Atlantic coastline to black Americans recently freed from bondage. President Abraham Lincoln and Congress gave their approval, and soon 40,000 freedmen in the South had started to build and plant. But then within months of Lincoln's assassination, President Johnson rescinded the order and returned the land to its former owners. Congress made another attempt at compensation, but Johnson vetoed it. Now, in the early phase of the 2020 presidential campaign, the question of compensating black Americans for suffering under slavery and other forms of racial injustice has resurfaced. The economics of the situation have long been studied. When James Forman, a civil rights pioneer who later served briefly as the Black Panther Party's foreign minister, demanded $500 million in reparations in his 1969 Black Manifesto, he grounded his argument in an indisputable fact. Unpaid slave labor helped build the American economy, creating vast wealth that African Americans were barred from sharing. The manifesto called for white Christian churches and Jewish synagogues to pay for projects like a black university and a Southern land bank. The question of reparations, however, extends far beyond the roughly 4 million people who were enslaved when the Civil War started. Ta-Nehisi Coates explained in an influential essay published in The Atlantic back in 2014, and he said that legalized discrimination and state-sanctioned brutality, murder, dispossession, and disenfranchisement continued long after the war ended. That history profoundly handicapped black Americans' ability to create and accumulate wealth, as well as to gain access to jobs, housing, education, and health care. He wrote, quote, "For every dollar a typical white household holds, a black one has only 10 cents, end quote. It's this cumulative effect that justifies the payment of reparations to descendants of slaves long dead. Today, nearly 47 million Americans identify themselves as Black or African American in the latest census. A vast majority are descended from slaves, but others are more recent migrants. So, who would qualify for a payment? William A. Darity, Jr. is an economist at Duke University and a leading scholar on reparations, and he suggests two qualifying conditions. One, having at least one ancestor who was enslaved in the United States, and two, having identified oneself as African American on a legal document for at least a decade before the approval of any reparations. So according to those criteria, Oprah Winfrey, who has traced her DNA to slaves captured in West Africa in the early 19th century, she would qualify. However, former President Barack Obama, the son of a white American mother and a Kenyan father, would not. Mr. Darity estimates that approximately 30 million Americans would be eligible for reparations. So, how much would eligible people receive? It's difficult to throw out a single number because calculations are all over the board. But if we go back to Sherman's promise, there is a calculation that's been done. Darity, in his upcoming book, begins with the cost of an acre in 1865. That was about $10. 40 acres divided among a family of four comes to $10 an acre, or per person, rather, or about $100 for each of the 4 million former slaves. Taking account of compounding interest and inflation, Mr. Darity has put the present value at about $2.6 trillion. Assuming roughly 30 million descendants of ex-slaves, he concluded, it would work out to about $80,000 a person. So is there a history of reparations? Well, you might be surprised that there is. In the United States, after a congressional study, people of Japanese descent who were forced into internment camps during World War II received $20,000 in 1988 and a formal apology. And since 1952, Germany has paid more than $70 billion in reparations through various programs, primarily to Jewish victims of the Nazi regime, and continues to deliver hundreds of millions of dollars each year. So then the question becomes, what would be the impact on Black households and the economy? Well, according to the Federal Reserve's Survey of Consumer Finances, the median wealth of Black households is $16,000 compared with $163,000 for whites. Reparations are not likely to eliminate the racial wealth gap, but could narrow it somewhat. Low-income families with the fewest assets would benefit the most. The biggest economic objection is that any meaningful program would be unaffordable. Like other government spending, reparations would ultimately be paid by some kind of tax or fee, borrowing, if that need be, through government bonds. Such a program would almost certainly require increasing the federal debt and be structured over time. You see what you learn here? Harley-Davidson is taking a risk, but thinks it's time to try to rev up business. The company is introducing 100 new models through 2027, including its first electric bike, to find new customers outside a pack of aging riders in the United States. Harley expects buyers of those hogs to be younger and less wealthy than the baby boomers who drove its sales in recent decades, making financing more important to securing their business. The strategy does present new risks as Harley draws more of its revenue from lending. The company's financing unit generated more than 40% of operating income last year, up from 28% in 2012. Profit in the financing unit has held steady as overall operating income has declined due to lost sales. In each of the past 4 years, Harley's income has gone down, and Harley's shares are down 16% over last year. Coming up next, Jeff Pitts is the managing editor of City View Magazine, and he's got stuff to do in the DSM USA Metro, and that is coming up just a click away. Thanks for listening.